what a U.S. government shutdown could mean for Ukraine's counteroffensive.
Any delay in a critical weapon system like the F-16 could have an impact, but a lot of that is going to be determined again by whether or not a shutdown can be avoided.
Plus, Russia's president assigns a top Wagner Group commander to lead new efforts in its war on Ukraine.
The meeting underscored the Kremlin's attempt to show that the state had now gained control over the mercenary group after a failed June mutiny by its boss Yevgeny Prigozhin.
And later in the program, what some Ukrainian soldiers are doing to ensure they'll be able to have children after the war. Today is Friday, September 29th, from the Voice of America. This is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Lori London in Washington. The UN's top nuclear watchdog is holding its annual regular session this week. Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, said this week the situation remains highly vulnerable at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant in southern Ukraine. I spoke with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv, who says Ukraine is now playing a role in the meetings.
Ukraine has been elected to the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency, along with 10 other states. Basically, this is, as President Zelensky said, an opportunity for Ukraine to influence decisions and particularly in case of Ukraine to influence safety decisions on behalf of the Atomic Energy Agency and inside of the organization. What's important here as well is that it's not only this new role of Ukraine, but also members of the International Atomic Energy Agency at their annual general conference in Vienna adopted a resolution demanding that Russia immediately withdraw its troops from the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant and return the plant to the control of Ukraine. This is something that Ukraine was talking about for quite a long time, and President Zelensky himself as well. And this is actually, as President Zelensky mentioned, this is also an opportunity to implement the first phase of Ukraine's peace plan, peace formula, which is nuclear and radiation safety. So at this point, the agency has adopted such a decision that Russia has to withdraw all the troops and also allow the members of the Atomic Energy Agency to get to any part of the plant they wish, because at this point, there are a lot of limitations for those representatives of the agency who are currently located at the power plant.
Right, and the International Atomic Energy Agency Director General Rafael Mariana Grossi has been warning that he's concerned about the possibility of dangers facing the plant with numerous reports of explosions, military activity in the region. So I know there are also really big concerns about the fighting so close to the power plant and what that could mean.
Yes, exactly. And it's unfortunately, it's not only about the fighting, but also the International Atomic Energy Agency confirmed the mining around the plant and on the territory of the plant as well. And also Russian forces representatives and Russian military equipment present at the power plant. So this creates additional risks, of course. And as also Ukrainian officials and particularly President Zelensky mentioned in one of the statements months ago that basically Russian Federation might be planning certain acts which would be extremely risky and dangerous for the whole region.
Anna Chernikova reporting for VOA from Kyiv. Russian President Vladimir Putin was seen Friday meeting with one of the most senior former commanders of the Wagner mercenary group and discussing how to best use volunteer units in the Ukraine war. Olivia Chan with Reuters has more.
Russian President Vladimir Putin was shown on state television on Friday, meeting Andrei Troshev, one of the most senior former commanders of the Wagner mercenary group. They discussed how best to use volunteer units in the Ukraine war. The Kremlin said the meeting took place late on Thursday. Deputy Defense Minister Yunus Bek-Yukarov was also present. The meeting underscored the Kremlin's attempt to show that the state had now gained control over the mercenary group after a failed June mutiny by its boss Yevgeny Prigozhin. He was killed with other senior commanders with a plane crash in August. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov told the RIA news agency that Troshev now worked at the Defense Ministry. The fate of Wagner has been unclear since Prigozhin's failed mutiny and his death, after which Putin ordered Wagner fighters to sign an oath of allegiance to the Russian state, a move Prigozhin and many of his men had opposed. Russia's Kommersant newspaper has reported that just days after the Wagner mutiny, Putin has suggested that Trushev take over from Prigozhin. The meeting also appears to indicate that what remains of Wagner will now be overseen by Trushev and the defense minister. The Wagner group became best known for its May capture of the Ukrainian city of Bakhmut in the bloodiest battle of the war. Trushev is a decorated veteran of Russia's wars in Afghanistan and Chechnya. He is a former commander in the SOBR Interior Ministry Rapid Reaction Force.
Olivia Chan with Reuters reporting. Aid for Ukraine is one of the big issues causing the stalemate that's pushing the U.S. toward a government shutdown. White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby told ABC News' Good Morning America, supplemental funding for Ukraine is needed to keep up with military and humanitarian needs.
Without that supplemental funding, we could actually have a real significant problem supporting Ukraine as they get further into the fall and as they continue to try to prosecute this counteroffensive. Not only that, but our ability to restock our Pentagon's shelves.
I spoke with VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden about what the shutdown could mean for ongoing U.S. training efforts for Ukrainian forces.
Lori, the Pentagon has numerous officials who have come out in the past week or so talking about the potential for a government shutdown. And during a briefing with the media on Thursday, the deputy Pentagon press secretary called it the worst case scenario that they could be facing. Earlier in the week, the undersecretary of defense for sustainment and acquisition, who plays a huge role in acquiring weapon systems and munitions and that sort of thing, talked about the potential shutdown as something that is just not good. He said that there's nothing good that you can say about it, and that testing will stop, acceptance of government equipment will stop. So there's already the possibility that if there is a government shutdown, some of the munitions, other supplies, other military supplies that the U.S. intends to get to Ukraine that it has not yet sent over could be disrupted. Other packages that have not yet been announced or that the U.S. might want to announce to give Ukraine munitions and other supplies could be disrupted. So there's a lot that could happen. How exactly it plays out, it's not sure. In some cases, there could be waivers that are required to get around the shutdown and some of the blockages that could be caused if there is a shutdown, but a lot still is uncertain.
And what happens if some of these things are stalled out? How much impact could that have on the success of Ukraine's efforts to counter Russian troops?
No one with the Pentagon is publicly talking about what this would mean for Ukraine on the battlefield. There's been an effort to get Ukraine a lot of supplies through presidential drawdown authority, sending it from U.S. stocks immediately. The Ukrainian government announced earlier this week, and the U.S. was talking about the long-awaited M1 Abrams tanks, the top-of-the-line U.S. tanks that were promised months ago, have now started to arrive in Ukraine. So there is a continued flow of weapons and support. But you've got to take a step back and look at this from the bigger perspective. If there is a government shutdown, a lot of the Pentagon's military workforce, its service members in the Air Force, the Navy, the Marines, the Army, they'll continue to work. That's about 2.1 million service members, although they won't be getting paid. The bigger impact is on the support staff. When you talk about some almost 800,000 civilian employees that work for the Defense Department who play critical roles in supporting the military members. And then also there's going to be an impact on the contractors. And if you look back at the last fiscal year, the Defense Department had about over $200 billion in contracted services that help support many of these efforts. A lot of that goes into the contracting for the weapons and testing of weapon systems. So a lot of what happens could depend on if there is a shutdown, which there's still a chance that it can be avoided. And then if there is a shutdown, how long does that go on? How long are these critical personnel who are not uniformed military personnel furloughed? Because most of the civilian workforce for the Defense Department in the U.S. will be furloughed if the government is shut down. There will be an attempt by some of the military service members to pick up the slack. But again, the longer the shutdown goes on, the larger the implications can be.
What about the F-16 pilots that the U.S. is planning on training? Will that be stalled? And how much would that slow things down as far as their ability to use them?
There is a potential for an impact on the training of the Ukrainian F-16 F-16 pilots. Some of those pilots are in the U.S., have begun the English language training that they need so they can be able to operate the F-16s once they're delivered to Ukraine. That is something that could be impacted because at least some of the people who are involved in that training process are civilian personnel. They're not military personnel. So potentially some of the trainers may not be able to show up. So that will have some impact on how quickly these pilots are trained. Now, the critical thing to remember with the F-16s is that the U.S. looks at that not as an immediate need for Ukraine, but as a long-term need for Ukraine. The U.S. has not been looking at the provision of the F-16s as something that's going to impact Ukraine on the battlefield right now. They see it as something that Ukraine needs for the long term, but they see other needs, some of the air defense systems, some of the missile systems, some of the munitions that the U.S. has been providing Ukraine as higher priorities in terms of what's needed in the current fight. But over the long term, when there are delays and a war right now that's been described as somewhat of a stalemate, with neither side being able to advance much, partially because of the inability of either the Russians or the Ukrainians to establish air superiority, any delay in a critical weapon system like the F-16 could have an impact. But a lot of that is going to be determined, again, by whether or not a shutdown can be avoided. And if it cannot be avoided, how long does it last before the government eventually gets back up and running?
VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. Since Russia pulled out of a deal that allowed ships carrying Ukrainian grain to pass safely through the Black Sea, Ukraine has made impressive strides in circumventing the blockade. I spoke with Taya Dunleavy, senior analyst with the Center for Maritime Strategy. What you're tracking is innovative and successful Ukraine military strategies in the Black Sea, correct?
That's a great question, because for the past year, the maritime domain's really been left out of the conversation, largely within Ukraine's counteroffensive and within its defensive mechanisms. But as you say, we're seeing turning of the tides when it comes to the Western Black Sea, where Russia had been able to reshape the Western Black Sea to its liking and to its own interests. It's done this through many ways, even through the UN Black Sea Grain Initiative, which it de facto ended by pulling out in July, which was the deal with Ukraine and Turkey that facilitated exports. Even then, Russia used its power to slow down the pace of Ukrainian exports, to create logistical hurdles, and create other problems for Ukrainian shipping. But what we've been seeing now, as you point out, is we're seeing that the tides are turning. We're seeing Ukraine take an increasingly offensive approach within the Black Sea to regain access to waters that had normally, before the war, been safely operable for shipping and for its own security purposes. We see this in conjunction with a couple of different endeavors. One is partnership with various allies in order to facilitate Ukrainian grain exports and other types of agricultural products through land-based routes. This has included partnerships with Poland, Romania, increasingly the Baltics, and also in Croatia. But what's important about this new humanitarian corridor, even though it's described as temporary, it shows that Ukraine is able to ship its own products. It's able to rely on partnership of Romania and Bulgaria, who are NATO allies, by making this corridor tug along the coastlines of those two countries. This decreases the chance that Russian patrol vessels will harass Ukrainian vessels, because that's exactly what Russia has threatened to do and already last month has done. So this is a really impressive move by Ukraine to be able to maintain its status as a maritime nation where it can fully access the Black Sea for trade and for security.
And speaking of security, it looks like Ukraine is becoming more bold as going after Russian targets when it comes to the Black Sea.
Yes, that's definitely correct. And Ukraine has mentioned as well, has stated quite clearly, that just as Russia sees any vessels transporting to and from Ukraine, even if commercial vessels, that those could be potential military targets. Likewise, Ukraine has said that while Russian oil exports through the Black Sea or other types of exports are not necessarily safe either. So we see that Ukraine is becoming increasingly offensive, is a word that some might use to describe it, but really just reclaiming access to the Black Sea that Ukraine has maintained and has been essential for its trade, its economy, and its security.
Right. We are seeing literally last month a Ukrainian naval drone damaging a Russian warship. More recently, Moscow's naval headquarters near Crimea.
Yes, okay. In Sevastopol, exactly. And that was a huge attack for the reason that it's targeting Russian naval command and control and ability to operate in the Black Sea. So as you point out, not only is Ukraine capable of longer range strikes across the Black Sea, but also closer to its own coastal defenses.
Is there still a threat of Russia attacking shipments going out or through the area that it has blockaded?
Absolutely. Russia has stated that vessels transporting to and from Ukraine can be considered potential military targets, and that Russia will have the right, essentially, to search any vessels for the potential of military equipment on board. So it's definitely likely, and that's part of the Russian strategy, has been to intimidate the commercial shipping industry, to try and disincentivize commercial shippers from being willing to take the risk, because there's several risks. It's not only that Russia can stop a commercial vessel transporting to Ukraine, as it did last month, and film this incident of harassing the sailors who were not Ukrainian, but to make a point to the world, essentially, that it's not safe to ally with Ukraine. Russia will do that. Russia also, and not just Russia, Ukraine as well, there's a lot of sea mines that are floating around in the Black Sea, and that makes it difficult for shippers to safely navigate. So there's various different types of threats that exist. And even if a ship is not directly targeted, a commercial vessel is not directly targeted by Russian forces, I've tracked several incidents of commercial vessels being damaged, whether being nearby a strike or for other reasons. So even so, it's still a big issue of ensuring crew safety, and if shippers are willing to take on the costs of shipping through the Black Sea.
As we've said at the start of this conversation, Ukraine is really stepping up its efforts to use a new shipping route, allowing it to revive grain exports, circumventing the de facto Russian blockade of its Black Sea ports, and that has to be considered a success.
Yes, I would agree. So far, I've tracked 7 ships that have made it through the corridor, and that's absolutely a success, that none of these ships have been stopped, harassed. They've been able to reach their destinations. And not only that, but now vessels are starting to export grain, which is increasingly important, because every day that passes where there's not some kind of framework to protect Ukrainian grain exports, Ukrainian grain sitting in silos near ports like Odessa are targets for Russian airstrikes, missile strikes, and that's exactly what we've seen this week. So Ukraine's success is incredible, and it's assembling this patchwork quilt of systems that can export products, whether through allies, through land-based techniques, and also through this humanitarian corridor. It definitely can be considered a success.
Taya Dunleavy, senior analyst with the Center for Maritime Strategy, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has cast doubt on the prospect of the EU beginning negotiations anytime soon for Ukraine to join the bloc. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Speaking on state radio, Orban said the EU will have to answer very long and difficult questions until we get to the point where we can even decide whether to start negotiations. The European Council is set to begin accession talks in December, and Ukraine has said it hopes to join the bloc within 2 years. Orban, who has sparred with Kyiv over language rights for a Hungarian minority in western Ukraine, said on Friday that it would be unprecedented to admit a country that's at war. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
With their future on the battlefront uncertain, many of Ukraine's young male soldiers are choosing to freeze their sperm in a bid to guarantee children in the future. For VOA, Lija Bakalets reports from Kyiv.
Alyona, who wishes to remain anonymous for her own safety and privacy, is married to a Ukrainian soldier fighting on the front line. Several months ago, while he was on a short vacation, the couple decided to freeze his sperm using a process called cryopreservation.
My husband was even more into it than I was. He had a mate killed on the front who was only 27 years of age. He had neither a girlfriend nor a child. He left nothing behind. And for my husband, it was maybe an impulse that we must have a child despite any circumstances.
The couple came to this private fertility clinic. As their doctor explains, the procedure is simple for men.
The process does not require any special preparation. A man just needs to come in and submit biomaterial. Then we test it for infections and freeze it. Temperature is minus 196 degrees Celsius. Biomaterial could be in storage for years.
Dr. Hajilenka says that the cryopreservation is essential for soldiers because the risk of infertility is high among veterans.
This could be due to frostbite, hypothermia, and injuries to the lower half of the body. And we don't even guess how the mental stress the guys are under will affect them later.
Some private clinics in Ukraine offer free cryopreservation for military men.
We practically don't have days without military personnel in the clinic.
Members of Ukraine's parliament are pushing to make cryopreservation free for members of the military as part of a state program and have completed the draft legislation. But lawyers like Lyudmila Kirilenko argue the legislation falls short.
There is no mechanism for how it will happen in practical implementation. How will it be reimbursed from the state budget, local, or other funds? The main question in this draft law is how much to lay down in the budget and what the funding sources should be.
Alona is hoping to get pregnant. She had undergone tests and found the only way for her to do that was through assisted conception. Having her husband's sperm frozen means she can start the process even while he is on the front lines. Lesya Bakalets for VOA News, Kyiv.
Since the start of the war, American photographer and videographer Jonathan Brook has been going to Ukraine regularly, documenting the consequences of Russia's invasion and assisting Ukrainian rescuers. Katerina Mudrenko has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
This 32-ton specialized crane came to Ukraine from the UK, thanks to American photographer Jonathan Brook, who has been regularly coming to the war-torn country to help. Not only does Brook document everything he sees, but he also raises funds to help Ukrainian rescuers working round the clock.
This crane is going to be used in saving lives, helping to lift the heavy pieces of buildings that have collapsed on the civilians and save lives by helping them to be able to dig out people that have been buried under the rubble.
He also makes sure to record the work of Ukrainian rescuers. He's been doing it since the war started.
They're on the front lines of the civilian atrocities, defending the civilians. And the only protection they have is the helmets and ballistic vests that they wear on top of their heavy and hot fire suit.
Brooke has visited Ukraine several times already. For him, this is personal. His wife comes from Ukraine. Since the war began, Brooke has documented the destruction of the Kyiv region and the atrocities in Bucha, Irpin, and Borodyanka. He's been to Chernihiv and to the Zaporizhia and the Dnipropetrovsk regions, where he was especially impressed by the rescuers' work.
In places like Nikopol and Marganets, that are right close to the front line, to the nuclear power station that the Russians control, and they use it to attack the civilians in these civilian towns every single day since the war started.
When Brooke is back in his native California, he organizes exhibitions to show Americans what Ukrainians have to deal with every day of the war.
That is what victory looks like. Victory for Ukraine will look like total. All of the Russians pushed out of Ukraine. The Ukrainian prisoners and captives brought back. All of the children that have been stolen from Ukraine brought back. Reparations payment imposed on Russia to send help to Ukraine. And then all the war criminals prosecuted.
At the moment, Brooke is back in the U.S., preparing new photographic reports and finalizing new humanitarian aid packages. During his next visit, he hopes to bring hazmat suits and bulletproof vests that British policemen have purchased for Ukrainian rescuers. For Katerina Mudrenko in Dnipro, Ukraine, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage of Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on social media, just follow VOA News. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, we thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Lori London.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.